What's rather odd about this is I was expecting to see just two people in the audience who were sports nutritionists who'd come all this way because there is a beautiful building which is 123 meters tall. Hands up, who's in the KGB? Fuck off. Sorry. By the way, what's he doing? I've left the BBC so I can do this. What's he doing drinking red wine like this in front of all these good people? Actually, you may not be good. Who knows? It's simple. This is the best anti-Novichok prophylactic money can buy. There aren't that many kids in, so I shall start as I finish. Vladimir Putin, do fuck off. If you're looking for balance, go elsewhere. By the way, I am extremely touched that so many of you turned up. Because frankly, if I was you, I'd be in a pub somewhere. But anyway, this is kind of what is this? Is this kind of Glastonbury with history books? Or there's something, it's kind of cool, and I rather like it. I want to introduce you to my two members of security. Nikki, stand up. Nikki used to look after my dog. She's a train killer. And George is her gigolo. there is a baby. Is there a baby? Oh, there isn't a baby. There's somebody with a farting cushion. Anyway, I will get serious at some point, but first of all, I need to explain what the hell is this idiot doing wearing a silly Dutch hooligan hat? I do lots of gigs around the world. Oh, gosh, crikey, is that getting too loud? Or am I too... No, turn it down. Anyway, so I did a gig in Amsterdam a bit like this, and the nice lady sitting next to me, and there's lots and lots of people. It's a gig in Amsterdam, and I've forgotten that throughout the Battle of Kiev, I wore this hat, and I have lots of followers on Twitter and supporters in the Netherlands, because they think I'm a Dutch football hooligan. And I said to this nice lady who's standing next to me, I said, I follow you on Twitter and I think your stuff's very good. And I said, oh, that's right. Who are you? Well, I'm the mayor of Amsterdam. However, never mind Amsterdam and my silly orange hat, I'm very close to Salisbury. And talking about the darkness of Russian fascism in this part of the world is pretty bloody easy, I think, because anybody who's from this part of the world will know that the Russian state, when it wants to kill somebody, is pitiless and barbaric and dark. I don't have to tell you. But it starts for me in 2000, and I'm commissioned by, I'm still at the end of my career at The Observer, but I'm commissioned by Channel 4 to make a film about the Moscow apartment bombs and what's happening in Chechnya. And the Moscow, oh, by the way, shall I explain the hat, then I can take it off. I'll get back to this, but during the Battle of Kiev, it was freezing. And I knew I was sick of people running away from Vladimir Putin. I was sick of the West saying, okay, Putin, we don't want to cause trouble. I was sick of it. So I went out to Kyiv in mid-February, before the big war started in 22. I actually flew on Valentine's Day. I don't know about you. I've had some pretty bloody awful Valentine's days in my life. But this was the worst one, because you could feel the weight of the Russian heavy metal coming towards Ukraine. They hadn't invaded yet, but you could feel it. And I didn't think he would do it because it would make no sense for Putin to invade Ukraine. But at the same time, I thought, he's so deranged and so mad, it's possible he will do this. And I'm there. And at this time, I've left the BBC. I've no machinery. I've got no resources, not that much money, not a flak jacket, not a helmet. But I'm a man of simple taste. All I need is a hole in the ground and a bottle of Irish whiskey. And anyway, I'm wearing a duffel coat, as worn by Trevor Howard in The Third Man, playing Major Calloway, a camel-coloured duffel coat. And I'd bought this hat in an Italian ski resort. And I went late season, I went to the shop, I'm bald, I need a hat. And the guy gives me this. And I said, I don't want that. Have you got a proper colour, like black? And he said, no, but for you, €3. So I buy the hat, I put it in my pocket, and I forget about it. But it's cold in Kyiv, the Russians are close, and then the big war happens, and I put it on my head. And some of the things that I have to do, we all have to do as reporters, are dark and difficult and terrible. So very, very early on, I'm going to throw it away now because it's too hot. Very early on, the Russians hit the Kyiv TV tower with two cruise missiles. The first hit the Kyiv TV tower and killed the technician. And I have to say, not willingly, but by accident, I stood in the dead man's blood. You look down and you see what you're doing. And then and I'd got up very early in the morning and I'd actually, you couldn't get taxis for love of money, and I just walked out in the street and stopped the car. The guy had to kill me or stop. And I sort of gave him €50, and actually he refused. He took €10, but nevertheless, I wanted to go to the Kyiv TV tower, but they hit it. Yes, that's why I want to go. I'm a reporter. So he drives me there, and it's a terrible Skoda with wheel bearing problems. And it like this the whole way, which means that when you get to the checkpoints, and there are tons of checkpoints in Kyiv at that moment, there's a CNN, and they've got a G-Wagon, one of those Mercedes that looks like a tank. And CNN has stopped. And I don't look fancy at all. I'm in this terrible car with screeching. And we sail through the checkpoints because the car's so terrible. Nobody thinks I'm a journalist. So I get to the Kyiv TV tower tragedy in the morning after the Russians had hit it like the night before anyone else. And what I see is the people from the morgue picking up an old man, the corpse of an old man, the corpse of a mother and her five-year-old child. And I stand away, but you can all see this on Twitter. I stand away, but I film it from a distance, so it's not horrible, but it is horrible. When the Kremlin says they don't target civilians, they're lying. Then a couple of days later, I go to the hospital, and there's been an evacuation of kids with cancer. You can put kids with cancer in an ambulance and drive them to Poland, they're going to be okay. But you can't if they're on dialysis machines. And so these kids, they're yellow. And the hospital take me down. For some reason, I've got in again. And there's a dialysis machine, and there's one kid on the dialysis machine. They said, no, no, no. And they take me downstairs into a basement, and it's full of filing cabinets and kind of air conditioning tubes or boiler tubes and old filing cabinets and sick kids whose faces are yellow because there's something desperately wrong with their liver or kidneys. And they're on dialysis machines. And the Russian army is 12 miles away from the center of Kyiv. So in London terms, if this hospital was St. Thomas's, very near where I live, just opposite Parliament, the Russian army would be in Enfield or Wembley, that kind of distance, that close. You can hear the shells, you boom, 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 the whole time. And if these kids leave their dialysis machines, they will die. But if they stay, and the Russians take the capital, they may die. And there's a clown. And the clown, I don't like clowns. I don't like their enforced hilarity. I don't like them. But the clown's really good. She's a woman, and she's a refugee from Donetsk, which the Russians took in 2014. And she's brave and funny and good, and she's making these five-year-old, six-year-old, seven-year-old kids really laugh. But there's a 14-year-old girl, again, with this sad yellow face, because there's something terribly wrong with her liver, kidney functions, whatever. And she's distancing herself from the kids because she's about to become a young woman. And anyway, I get chatting to her. She speaks good English. She's a bright, bright, bright person. And the clown's sensitive, senses the girl's a little bit distant, and says, "What's your name?" And she's Alyona. And she goes, and the clown goes, Elon Musk? And the idea of Elon Musk in there, and the thing is, I start laughing, and the girl laughs too, and the clown is good, and then she's doing some magic with the kids, and it's kind of wonderful. And I start laughing, and then I know what's about to happen is I'm going to cry. And because of COVID, and also because these kids are in danger of infection, we're all wearing masks. And I'm grateful for the mask because it's hiding the fact that I'm crying. And I'm really crying. And I have to say goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Anyway, I get up, and then you can hear the Russian. And I don't have a flak jacket or a helmet, so I can't go to the front line. What I'm trying to do is tell the stories from here, from the center of Kyiv. That's all I do. Anyway, one of my pals says there's a bar. And martial law has been declared. You cannot get a drink for love or money. Excuse me, hold on. It's against the Novichok. And it's a bar called the Buena Vista, and it's a Cuban bar. And you go down the stairs, and there's a Ukrainian army checkpoint right there, just by the bar. And I've become a little bit famous because my videos at this point. Anyway, maybe another day. But this happens: the boys on the checkpoint, who look like Black Beatles with big fancy guns, they want a selfie with me. And I have a Waitrose bag, and in the Waitrose bag, there are seven bottles of Italian wine I bought from the bar. And they want a selfie with me, and they're grabbing me by the shoulders. And I'm trying not to get the Waitrose bag to clink. I mean, I think the Chalk Valley Historical Festival will appreciate the irony of this. But it's so weird. And the bar is beautiful and good. And it's kind of a place where I can talk to my friends, other British and American and European and Japanese and Indian journalists, about what we've seen that day. And you get a sense of release and some a switch off from, and there are old couples dancing the cha-cha-cha and the foxtrot, where you can hear boom, boom, boom. They're dancing in defiance of the Russian terror machine. It's kind of beautiful. And before you know it, it's 10 o'clock. Curfew is at 9 o'clock. And I live down the hill in the Maidan. I've got an Airbnb above McDonald's, so I'm in trouble. And this is when my hat becomes rather beautiful, because it's after curfew and you can die. Because the Ukrainians are so worried about the Russians. They're worried about people. They're worried that we're all Russian spies. And as I come down the hill, these Ukrainian National Guard cops come out and go, "Wah, wah," in Ukrainian. I did Russian at school, and I'm rubbish at it. Я говорю по-русски, как испанская корова. Anybody need to speak Russian here? You're all sports nutritionists. Come on. Anyway, I've just said I speak Russian like a Spanish cow. My other phrase, which when somebody in Russia points a gun at you, and this has happened, and I have been arrested by the FSB on several occasions, but my favorite phrase is, "Ya glupi gnom," I'm a stupid dwarf. And they go, "No, you're not a dwarf." And then it means they're not going to kill you because we're arguing about the correct... Oh, so I'm sorry, Izvini. I didn't mean dwarf. But it means we're into an argument about words rather than I'm going to kill you. Anyway, I'm wearing the hat, and that's not military. It's not military at all. And the Ukrainians are saying, "What are you doing? It's an hour after curfew." And I go, "God save the Queen." And then the only phrase I've learnt in Ukrainian is Putin Hulia, which is Putin's a dickhead. These two phrases said back to back in a very English accent. And the Ukrainian cops go, "Don't do this again. We don't want to see you again. Go down the hill. Fuck off," in Ukrainian. The next night, I see something grim, and I drink too much, I stay too long, and I'm crushing the curfew again. And they come out from the shadows, and I, "God save the Queen, Putin," and I get it wrong. I start saying Putin Julio, as in Julio Iglesias, Putin Julio, and... "Oh, fuck off." The third night, hats. "God save the Queen." Before I say it, Ukrainian cops look at me and go, "God save the Queen." And then, from then onwards, all of my British and American and European reporter friends knew that I could get them out of hours from the Buena Vista down to the hill because... everybody knew that. So my hat became my lucky orange hat. And down the track, I auctioned it on a crowdfunder. £5 a ticket, and the money goes to support Ukrainian charities. And the hat raised £15,000. And the guy who won for Ukrainian charities and the guy who won it gave it back to me because he said it still has work to do. The issue for me is if I wash it, then I think it'll lose its magic power. So it stinks. But anyway, I'll take it off. I want to explain to you how much I care about standing up to Russian fascism. And it starts, as I said, in 2000. Where I go to Moscow and I go to Ryazan. And what's happened in Moscow in September 99, immediately Putin takes over, is a series of bombs which kill 300 people in Moscow. And the people who are blamed are the Chechens, and Putin uses this as a casus belli to invade Chechnya, which is an autonomous state, very Muslim, mountainous people, and hammer their capital, Grozny. And there's an issue because there's something suspicious about these bombs. And the FSB, new word for the KGB, they blame it on the Chechens. But the moment the bomb outrages has happened, the police come in and the bulldozers come in and they bulldoze all the evidence. There's no good evidence that Chechens did this. There's another bomb that doesn't go off in a place called Ryazan, and I go there in February 2000, and I talk to the locals, and I say, "Who planted the bomb? And was it Chechens?" "No, there were two Russians and a woman, blonde, with a bob." And the locals were worried because this is after the Moscow apartment bombs, and they were worried, and they called the local cops, and the local cops had, it so happened, a former bomb squad guy in the police department, and he's got his own explosive detector. He goes in, he finds military grade hexagon, and they evacuate this block of flats at 3 o'clock in the morning. And there's a very old woman who's dying, and they evacuate her too. They evacuate everybody. This is a real thing. And what happens is the local police find the car of the three people, and as they're leaving Raisan, and they flash their FSB cards, and they're let go. So what this points to is the people who blew up Russia were not the Chechens. It was the Russian secret police. And that starts in September 99. Now, I'm there in February, and I go to Chechnya undercover. And we pay an FSB guy, a secret police guy, $2,500. He's dead now, so I can tell this story. The Russians killed him. Not because of us, because of other people, I think, but who knows. Anyway, they killed this guy, but he smuggled us in. $2,500, we were in a Volga, and it was club class going through the checkpoint, the Russian army checkpoints, because we're with the secret police. And we get out, and we find an old man, and his family has been bombed with a fuel-air explosive. Now, a fuel-air explosive is, it's a bomb that descends, it's petroleum jelly, and it lands, there's the first explosion, and there's a big cloud of petroleum jelly. And there's a second explosion that ignites it, and all the oxygen in a place like this is gone. And everybody's lungs are sucked inside out and incinerated at around about 700 degrees centigrade. That's what this stuff does. And it's banned against civilians. And this man had lost 14 members of his family. He was on sticks. And I said, listen, if we film you, we want to film you, but if we film you, the Russians may kill you. He said, I don't give a fuck, film me. And I came away, and I wrote a piece for The Observer, my old paper, in March 2000, and I called Vladimir Putin a war criminal. And according to my friends in the Russian opposition, I was the first journalist to call, or one of the first, to call Putin a war criminal. A few months later, Tony Blair and George W. Bush are in love with Putin, and I don't understand this. It's wrong. And there's a press conference in London, Putin, Blair, Alistair Campbell is picking the media, and I lift up my hands, and I'm a big guy, and I've got a presence, and Alistair Campbell can't see me. 24 years later, he does a thing for the rest of his politics, and he writes a piece about it in the European, in which he says, I actually did see Sweeney, and I regret not calling him. And I actually think Sweeney was right about Putin, and we, him and Tony Blair, were wrong. Chalk Valley, there is more joy in heaven for the sinner that repenteth. But it was very, very frustrating to know that there was something very, very dark about Putin from the get-go. And I can't, it still angers and upsets me that I failed to get this across as best I could. And I'm a natural storyteller, but I felt very, very, very sure that there was something very dark about Vladimir Putin. And yes, listen, I've been rocketed by the Taliban 7 times in Pakistan. I've been chased by the Taliban in Afghanistan. They didn't get us, but they got 3 Italian journalists who were traveling in the car behind, and they killed them. So I'm not an idiot or a fool about the threat from radical Islam. But the threat from Russia is far, far worse. I mean, I'm not going to piss about here. I call Brexit the Kremlin's Brexit. Aaron Banks was married to a Russian. Aaron Banks was investigated by the Electoral Commission and investigated by the National Crime Agency, and they cleared him. But my friend Christopher Steele, who I only knew after he left MI6, who was the head of the Russia department at MI6, he tells me, over a glass of vodka martini in the Polish club. We go to the Polish club because we trust them not to poison us. He goes, hey, vodka martini, shaken, not stirred. Anyway, Chris says, neither the Electoral Commission nor the National Crime Agency have the chops to properly investigate how the Russian dark state may have affected Brexit. They don't have the firepower to do that. Whenever I meet Aaron Banks, I crack a joke about the men who've got snow on their boots. But the men who've got snow on their boots kill people. You know this because you know the story of Dawn Sturgis, right? The Wiltshire lass whose boyfriend, they haven't got any money, they've got their troubles. He finds a nice perfume bottle, he gives it to his girlfriend, and his girlfriend dies of Novichok poisoning because the Russian assassins out to kill Skripal have left it in a hedge. He doesn't know that. But actually, people at the top of British government, they knew about what happened in Ryazan. They knew about the questions about the Moscow apartment bombs. There was another bomb that went off in Volgodonsk, and the Putinist speaker of the Duma, the Russian parliament, in 2000 said there's a bomb that's gone off in Volgodonsk. He was wrong about that. A bomb went off in Volgodonsk 3 days later. How did he know? So I believe that both Bush and Blair knew about this stuff, but they liked the idea of Putin and they didn't want to fall out with him. And Putin is hyper-aggressive. So he keeps on pushing and pushing and pushing. I'm talking about... Oh, by the way, as a security measure, I've misspelt my name. Oh, when it started, it was John Sweeney without lots of E's, and they put it in. I was going to have a go. Anyway, never mind. Well done, whoever organized that. So... I'm going to talk about Navalny at the end of this, but let me talk about one other thing. The summer of 2014, the BBC announces redundancy of all the London-based Panorama reporters. And they're actually trying to sack me, but they have to sack everybody else to get rid of me. It's a bit tragic. But Fiona Bruce is going to report Panoramas. But she can't, and what's happened is, that happens in the morning. In the afternoon, the Russians shoot down MH17 flying from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur and kill 298 people on board. Fiona Bruce is doing Panorama, but she can't go to Panorama that weekend because she's doing Antiques Roadshow from Devizes. And so... So I said, well, listen, I'll go. And they because it's going to take a while for them to get rid of me, so I go. And I go. And the land there, it's like a frozen Atlantic Ocean. It's like that. And there's a difference about 3 or 4 or 5 miles between the hill, the valley, again and again and again, in eastern Ukraine. The land is rich. Cornfields, sunflowers. And the sunflowers, the tail of a plane and the nose cone of a plane. And then the wheels and the engines and a stink of kerosene. And ladies' hats, and the books you take on holiday to read at the beach, and dead people, and bits of dead people, and the honey sick smell of the dead. And the thing that makes me cry to this day is the trunkies, those little things that toddlers wheel by mum and dad amongst the engines, yeah. And I get back to London. I say, I want to doorstep this fucker. I want to doorstep Vladimir Putin. And there's a fantasy meeting. And remember, I'm just the gob on the stick, and there's lots of clever people at Panorama. And somebody says, it's impossible. You cannot doorstep Vladimir Putin in Moscow and St. Petersburg. The security, you won't get within a mile of him. You're talking rubbish. You have no chance. And somebody else says, but in the sticks, sometimes they make mistakes. And a third person says, he's opening a mammoth museum in Siberia. And the editor of Panorama says, have we got any reporters that look like a professor of mammothology? And I go, fucking hell. It's my niece's wedding, and I get hammered. I'm Irish, of an Irish ancestry. I got a fancy suit, but I spilt red wine all over my shirt, and I've forgotten. Or anyway, I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning with the wine-stained shirt, and it's all a disaster. And I get to Gatwick. I fly at 7 o'clock, Gatwick to Moscow, change airports, Moscow to Yakutsk, 9 time zones east of London, further east than Beijing. And and there's no fucking food on the Aeroflot from Moscow to Yakutsk. And I arrive, and the producer said, we've got no time. We've got no, fuck off, I need a kebab. We stop. Kebab. And I wolf the kebab, and then we rock up. And the wine stain, I could not have been better dressed if I tried. There are 9 professors of mammothology, and then there are 10. We're all shaking. They're shaking because they're about to meet Vladimir Putin. I'm shaking because I've got delirious tremens from my niece's wedding. They've all got wine stains on their shirts. So have I. All of our suits are shabby. And anyway, Putin rocks up, and he's like a small pimp, nasty bouncer, the small bouncer, the one you should be really scared of at a nightclub, the kind of dodgy place you might go to in Salisbury. Anyway, he rocks up, and I jump in front of all the other professors of mammothology, and I go, John Sweeney from BBC Panorama, tell me about the killings in Ukraine, tell me about MH17. And all of the Kremlin media switch their lights on, and they think, this is a prearranged, approved question. And we fucked the Kremlin. Peskov, the PR man, is intensely angry. He's translating, because Nick Sturdy, my great tutor producer, who's there, he's shooting. He's not translating. And so Peskov has to translate. Peskov is so angry with me, he forgets his English. And Putin, who pretends not to speak English but does, has to start translating for Peskov when he's making mistakes. And it's so funny. Anyway, Putin's short, kind of Tom Cruise short. Have I talked about Scientology? That's another day. Anyway, so there's old Putin. He's had Botox, he's shiny. I kind of want to touch his face and say, is that for real? But remember, I'm hungover. Anyway, there's this, it's hot, and he's droning on. So what Putin does, he goes on for and on and on and on. And it's scary and boring and hot. And then suddenly I realize there's a problem with the kebab. And the kebab is slowly coming up my stomach. And Putin's like 5'6" or something like that. I'm 5'11". And I think, so here's the positive. If I projectile vomit over the Russian Federation, I'll never have to buy a beer in Kyiv ever again. But am I going to fucking make it? You know, will I get out of there? And the kebab is yo-yoing up and down my esophagus. I'm sure not the ladies here, but the boys, you will have experienced this. You know, I'm trying to talk nicely to mother-in-law-to-be or whatever, and suddenly, bleh. So, but this is Putin. By the way, I've forgotten, when I first had a go, when I first asked a question, Putin came across in a very effeminate way, as if part of him, and this sounds a bit odd, part of him kind of fancied me because of it. Look, listen, I have never, I don't know about you, the men here, I have never taken a picture of myself topless on a horse. The reason being, every time I've been on a fucking horse, I fall off it in 5 seconds. But I've never had time to get my top off. But actually, I think that's a very homoerotic picture. And I can talk, if somebody asks me a question about Putin's sexuality, if you dare, I'll answer it. I don't think I'm joking. Anyway, this fucking kebab, your yo-yo's up and down my stomach. And I, keep it down. They're going to kill you if you fucking throw up over Putin. On the other hand, you'll be famous. But it stays down. And my Ukrainian pals go, you could have thrown up over Putin. You didn't. What's fucking wrong with you? Anyway, what happened was they took us down to a meeting room. In the basement, our phones don't work. And there was a click. Nick and I are in a room. Now, things have improved since Stalin's day, because there's coffee and croissants in this room. But on the other hand, but it's an opaque kind of frosted door, and there's a big man, and we can't get out. And BBC management, who I call the jellyfish, and probably not a good career move, but anyway, the jellyfish are desperate to talk to him. What have you done? What have you done now? Who have you upset? And did you understand that the deputy director general is going to Moscow for the Olympics? Whatever it was, all of that stuff can't happen because we've got no phone signal. After an hour, they let us go. And in the afternoon, there's a meeting with the deputy Chinese vice president, minister, prime minister, and they're opening a pipeline, a Chinese-Russian pipeline. It's actually not true. They're doing a junction, but no one's built the pipeline. To this day, no one's. All the pipelines go to Europe. They don't go south to China. And so, but nevertheless, it's a symbolic thing. There's Putin. There's the deputy Chinese vice premier. And I don't care. The room's as big as this, maybe bigger. It's like a hangar. And Putin and the Chinese guy are there, and I'm on the floor at the back. I don't care. And somebody comes up to me and hits me in the gut. And by the time I look up, he's gone. That's the Kremlin saying, we didn't like your question. So when someone like J.D. Vance, the Vice President of the United States, criticizes Europe for its failure to have respect freedom of speech properly, I have to say, fuck you. You don't know what you're fucking talking about. Four Russian friends of mine, people I really admire, I will count them as friends. I don't know them very well. I didn't know them very well, but I've interviewed all of them. Anna Politkovskaya, Natasha Estemirova, Boris Nemtsov, Alexei Navalny, in order, poison then shot, 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 poison survived, poisoned again died. If you challenge the killer in the Kremlin, you may die. Alexei Navalny. I first meet him in January 2018. He's suing the Russian government at the European Court of Human Rights, which Russia is still at that point a signatory to, no longer. He's suing them because he hasn't been allowed to stand against Putin in the presidential elections because of some trumped-up nonsense they put against him. He's suing them. And he's got 5 minutes. I'm making a panorama called Taking on Putin. And I'm working with my great friend and a brilliant BBC cameraman, Seamus McCracken. And I say, Alexei, Seamus is from Northern Ireland. Seamus stops work. And I go, I'm terribly sorry. Seamus is from the north of the island of Ireland. And the thing about Alexei Navalny is a tremendous sense of mischief and a great sense of humor. And he smells my anxiety. And he goes to Seamus and he says, Seamus,
Are you happy to work with this British imperialist? And I just need a fucking soundbite. That's all. 5 seconds, 10 seconds. I don't care. So I'm terribly... Anyway, Seamus is fine. And we get something. Later on, I get to interview... The Russians give me a visa, but not a press card. They won't issue a press card to try and fuck me in the way they do. And nevertheless, off we go. And... Seamus and I get arrested and we get locked up in the Russian police station for a day. And that's kind of par for the course. But that night, Strasbourg's a difficult place to get out of. We're in Strasbourg and Seamus and I have a lovely drink. And we're both really, really struck by Alexei because... We both met. He's a cameraman, I'm a reporter. And also, this is the view of, I keep on forgetting her name, but there's a lovely woman who is the international reporter, international editor for CNN. And all three of us think the same thing, which is we meet presidents and prime ministers all the time, really charismatic people. But this is what the CNN lady said, but I've never met somebody who is a potential leader of their country, who goes back to that country knowing they may well be locked up for a long time or forever, or may be killed, and cracks jokes. Seamus is from the north of the island of Ireland. He's from Ballymena, an Irish Republican through democratic means, but over a beer, he said, "Hey, John, filming you, filming Navalny, it was like filming two big dogs sniff each other's bottoms." Quite weird how charismatic he was. We go to Russia, and... There's a guy who's a road sweeper who supports Navalny, and he wears a Vladimir Putin mask at Navalny's demos. And then one day at 6 o'clock in the morning in the winter on his way to work, two men come and one tases him and the other stabs him, and they leave him to bleed to death in the snow. And some passers-by find him and save his life. That's the guy who wears a Putin mask. One of the other guys does videos he's live streaming from his phone the Russian police attacking the Navalny supporters, and he's doing it from the fifth floor of a council flat. And with a live stream, you can work out whether the person who's shooting it can do that. And these two guys find him and beat him black and blue so his face looks like a blackberry. And this is 2018. And then there's a guy who's Alexei Navalny's office manager. And he's hit over the head with an iron bar. There's a newspaper, but inside the newspaper is an iron bar. And then the guy who does that, he says, "Sorted, and you can pay me the $200 now." And while the victim, Navalny's office manager, is in hospital with a fractured skull, the police arrest him for faking this attack. So he's been attacked, he's got a fractured skull, and the police arrest him for faking it, for bringing it on himself. This is Russian fascism. It felt like being inside Berlin in 1933 after the Nazis had taken over. I interview Alexei. I said, "Is Russia a police state?" And he said, "Yes, absolutely, 100%. So you read his book. Don't tell my publishers, but read his book. If you want to read one book about Navalny, read his book. My book is Warts and All, and it tells some of these stories and some of the flavor of this stuff. So if you can, read my book too. But Navalny was a hero to me. He was extraordinary. Why did he go back? after he'd been poisoned, recovered. He goes back. One of the reasons is that because he really, 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 really wanted to bring down Putin. A second reason, which is incredibly honorable and moving and powerful, is because he believed in another Russia, a good Russian that doesn't murder people, a Russia that's part of the normal kind of civilized society, the one that we have, the one the Americans used to have. And the third reason was he had a real Christian faith. Listen, I'm a very, very bad Catholic. I do nothing. I break all the Catholic rules, nearly all of them. But Craig Brown is a wonderful writer who does the parodies in Private Eye, once said, in a packed church full of people, I'm an atheist. In an empty church, sometimes I'm touched by the presence of God. That's kind of where I sit in this stuff. But Alexei had a sense, and I'm not like this, he had a sense of being, that martyrdom was not the worst thing that could happen to you. Being murdered by the Russian state for standing up for the idea that the, not every Russian went along with Putin. That was the thing. So I've met these people, Anna and Natasha and Boris Nemtsov and Alexei Navalny. I've met them, and they're critical of Putin, and they're no longer alive. So you've got to say, and by the way, I'm a liberal, and I used to be Labour, but I'm not a natural fan of the royal family, but as far as I'm concerned, there is only one fucking king in the English-speaking world, and that's the King of Canada, and also us. It's not the orange one. And the Orange King doesn't understand any of this, and nor it seems does any of the people around him, but they should. I want to finish there's a beautiful and good woman called Victoria Amelina, because the Ukrainians understand this more than anybody else. And they, more than anything else, they get it that democracy must be defended, that free speech does not come free. So she wrote this poem, Air Raid Sirens. Air raid sirens across the country. It feels like everyone is brought out for execution, but only one person gets targeted. Usually the one at the edge. This time not you. All clear. I think it was yesterday, the anniversary, 2 years ago in 23, she went with my normal fixer, Dima, towards the front line with some South American journalists and politicians, shows them the nature of the war, and then they go for a pizza in the rear pizzeria, and I've been there many, many times in Kramatorsk, and the Russians put a cruise missile into it, and she's dead. We have to arm ourselves, and we have to arm Ukraine properly, and we have to stop mucking about with sanctions, and we have to do it, and we have to really, really hurt the Russian economy, because this war will never stop until Putin is defeated. Some questions as a thing. There's a bloke with a kind of, I kind of like this as a liberal Democrat, There's a kind of liberal democrat coloured thing. But anyway, by the way, hold on, that's unfair. There are lots of good people in Labour and the Conservative Party and the Greens who are very strong about standing up to Vladimir Putin. If I didn't add reform in that, there was a reason for it. There's a question there.
Why did Prigozhin stop his advance on Moscow? And could be...
Can you say that again?
Why did Prigozhin stop his advance on Moscow? And could be what follows Putin be worse than Putin?
Yes, so I always like it when people ask two questions. I much prefer 10. So Prigozhin is the guy who's the hard bastard who runs the Wagner army. He's very angry with the Russian Ministry of Defense, and he runs this kind of mutiny. But it's a bit like one of the barons who actually loves King John, who doesn't want to take King John's place. He wants to replace the barons close to him. It's that kind of thing that's going on. But he leaves the Wagner army, gets out of Ukraine, which has been... They got Bakhmut. I went to Bakhmut 7 times in 22, and it was a hell of a battle. Really horrible. But they get it. And then Prigozhin is so angry with the corruption, and Russia is deeply corrupt. He invades and he goes to Rostov on Don, which is a huge Russian city in the south, and no one stops him. Not a single Russian secret policeman stops Prigozhin and his army from mounting an effective mutiny, or is it a coup, against the Kremlin. And they get closer and closer, and they get to like 100 miles of Moscow, and then suddenly it stops. So my working hypothesis, which I set out in my book about Navalny, Murder in the Gulag, is that, and this is, I don't know, but this is what I think, and I've been I've been a criminologist since my professor at LSE in 1977, Leonard Shapiro, described as a small boy living through both Russian revolutions, the one in February and the one in October. He said the first one was interesting, the second one was boring, and we carried on playing cowboys and Indians. But I think what happens is that suddenly something like this, and it's something like this, I don't know, that Prigozhin's got grandchildren, maybe a granddaughter, and suddenly she disappears from the nursery. Gone. And then his daughter or his son phones and said, they've taken my kid. That's the kind of thing which should stop Prigozhin. There's a deal. Putin does a deal. I understand your criticisms. Step down, get out the limelight, it's okay. 2 months later, a bomb in his plane, and everybody is dead in Prigozhin's circle. Donald Trump, can you observe this reality? Can you look at this? But that's what I think happened. And then your second question was, do you think, I mean, is it possible that who comes after Putin is worse? There was a joke in 45 after the fall of Nazi Germany that Hitler would come back and this time no more Mr. Nice Guy. So there is a kind of feeling inside when you're dealing with a monster like Hitler or Putin that actually somebody may come along worse. But I don't think so. I think that Putin is a particularly, peculiarly aggressive and successful psychopath. What's happened, I reported on the Romanian Revolution. I, in a kind of sense, I spent Christmas with the Ceausescus. Peter O'Toole was asked in the January, did you have a good Christmas? And he said, yes, but not as interesting as the Ceausescus. But I do feel that Putin has that since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the great revolutions, I did the Czech Revolution and the Romanian Revolution, and it was bloody and scary. But we all thought, all the reporters thought, that what would happen is that the West would democratize the East, Russia, then China. But actually what's happened is that Russia has Putinized or corrupted the West. And so you've got in Donald Trump somebody who feels more like Putin than any other previous president of the United States. So I think, and I also feel that Brexit was empowered by dark Russian money, and that Brexit was pushed along by the Russian troll factories. And if you look across the piece, you will see that the Russian dark state has funded the Front National in France, has stuff with Salvini and the far right in Italy. Tommy Robinson's been to Russia. Of course he has. Of course he has. So I don't think, if Putin dies and they come up with another KGB thug, he won't be as smart, as clever as Putin as doing stuff. So I'm an optimist. We need to help Ukraine's, the war won't stop, and the threat against us won't stop until Putin is dead. And we need to help Ukraine do that. And I'm not afraid of what happens next. We need to get rid of Putin. Next question, here.
We've heard lots of theories during the week about what Putin has on Trump. What do you think Vladimir Putin has on Donald Trump that makes him behave the way he does?
Do you want to get me killed? So my friend Christopher Steele, who used to be the head of the Russia Department of MI6, they call it the Russia House. He wrote the report that but I'm trying to drink this without getting this fucking thing here. So. I managed to do it. He wrote this private report for the Democratic Party, which set out the evidence that Trump had been in some way sex compromised. Now, let's leave Chris aside for a second because he's got skin in the game. But Sir Andrew North, who was Chris's ambassador when he was the top MI6 boss, has told me, listen, Trump's brother was an alcoholic. Fred Trump died of alcohol poisoning. Trump's a sexaholic. The idea that the KGB, FSB, whatever you call them these days, that they're not interested in somebody like him, that's ridiculous. And by the way, so Trump's response to this is, listen, there was some kind of pee-pee show. There was somebody pissed on somebody. And Trump said, that's not me, I'm a germaphobe. So the story I've heard is Trump, no one pisses on Trump. Trump's watching the show. There is a black prostitute who's playing Michelle Obama. And it's she who is pissed on by somebody else. And Trump finds this amusing. Another version is that it's dark, dark. What? I don't know. And I don't know this for a fact. And Chris didn't have a photograph or a video to prove it. But he never meant this report to be public. So it's different. If you're a journalist and you, like me, and you put stuff out, then you've got to get it through the lawyers. And sometimes the lawyers say, no, you don't. But Chris wasn't in that position. But you look at what Trump is doing at the moment. So at the NATO meeting, he was mildly critical of Putin. He gets back to the States and so Putin's been very nice. So it feels like there's something there. But By the way, you can be a Russian asset without knowing about it. Or you can be somebody like Trump sees how Putin controls the media, and you can be envious of it. So it's quite possible that Trump admires Putin and admires his political freedom to do what he will with the media without actually understanding that he's being their useful idiot. But useful idiot he is. I have to say, I'm not a huge fan of Keir Starmer, but after the horrible bullying of President Zelensky in the Oval Office, and then the first person he sees is Keir Starmer, and our Prime Minister gets off the step at Downing Street and walks down the street to welcome Zelensky and gives him a hug, I thought, good on you, Keir Starmer, good on you. And then when the King, and you, the very rarely you see pictures inside Sandringham, and there's a King in his fancy suit, and Zelensky's in his boiler suit, and the King doesn't give a fuck. And I thought, good on you, the King. And another thing, story in Private Eye, and I have nothing to do with Private Eye, but their telephone number is 0207-437-4017. How do I know that? The story is, King's got cancer, he's recovering, he's not a well man, and his doctors say, do not go to Canada. And the King goes to Canada, and the last line of the King's speech in the Canadian Parliament is, the true North is strong and free. Next question. Oh.
I fear we need to draw it to a close. Can I ask you to join me?
Right, yeah, boo.
Can I ask...
hold on, everybody. No, wait, I'm being unfair. Everybody's got to go home.
Can I ask you to join me in thanking John for an incredibly passionate and graphic description of the depraved foe that Ukraine are fighting and that we in Europe will surely face? Our huge thanks, John. Thank you very much indeed. I'll give you an orange hat there.